You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. I'm David Romillo, credentialed reporter and the host of Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Please make sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get the latest episodes. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't clean. A lot of it didn't make sense. But none of that matters because the Miami Heat have done the unexpected yet again and eliminated the Milwaukee Bucks to move on to the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time since the end of the Big Three era. I'll be recapping the game, give you the key takeaways from what worked and what didn't before start answering the questions you all submitted after the game. Where to begin? Giannis Antetokounmpo was warming up prior to the game, but the Bucks training staff ultimately decided that he shouldn't play, and that was absolutely the right decision. I also had concerns, though, given what we saw in Game 4, because the Heat had prepared and been built specifically for the purpose of challenging Giannis and the Bucks. Without him in the lineup, Milwaukee simply plays a different style of basketball, and Miami's defensive principles were less than effective. That proved to be the case in Game 5, too, when they couldn't stop the Bucks from getting whatever shot they wanted early on, and Milwaukee built an early 13-point lead at the end of the first quarter. The Bucks' offense was much more egalitarian. They moved the ball more. Scoring was much more spread out. It wasn't just dependent on Giannis driving to the rim and kicking it out to shooters. Miami's defense had to scramble more and deal with the size of Brook Lopez on the inside and the outside shooting of Chris Middleton and Dante DiVincenzo, who had struggled for most of the series but showed up in Game 4 and was inserted into the starting lineup with Antetokounmpo out. He chipped in 17 points, finished 3 of 6 from behind the line as well. Conversely, on offense, things looked really bad for Miami. Jimmy was very passive with the ball. He attempted just 6 shot attempts all game long, and he was being hounded all night by Wes Matthews, who did a hell of a job taking Butler out of the equation. Goran Dragic was shooting very poorly, especially in the first half, although he did finish with 17 points. And Duncan Robinson, who had a big game 4, was reduced to a non-factor by DiVincenzo, Matthews, and others. Robinson had just 2 points, a mid-range jumper, and only wound up taking 3 total shots. So it was not pretty for Miami's offense. But in the second quarter, they finally got a boost. Miami's bench was led by Tyler Hero and Kelly Olynyk, and they completely threw the Bucks' defense off balance. Between Olynyk's ball handling and floor spacing as a big, to Hero's ability to create his own shot regardless of who was defending him, the Heat outscored the Bucks 33-18 in the quarter. From that point forward, it was basically a back-and-forth game with Miami holding on to a slim lead and Milwaukee racing back. Middleton would score 23 points before falling out late in the game, and Butler would eventually start getting the calls that he seemed to be hunting all game long and shot 6 of his 8 free throw attempts within the last 2 minutes of the game. It was gritty, it was muddy, and ineffective was the kind of slow game that totally favors the Heat. They sealed the win 103-94 and again have moved on to the Eastern Conference Finals. And that's the big takeaway from this. They found a way to win. I had been kind of driving home this point earlier during the series when it didn't seem like Miami had a specific way that they managed to win. It was a big game from Jimmy in Game 1, then it was much more spread out in Game 2 with a couple of other players stepping up. In Game 3, Jimmy had to have a big fourth again, but they had key contributions from other players. And of course, in Game 4, Jimmy wasn't much of a factor. Hero came up big in the fourth quarter in overtime, and they managed to keep it somewhat close, even though Milwaukee wound up stealing that win to avoid the sweep. In Game 5 was a lot of the same thing. Jimmy was not the kind of player that we expect him to be. I don't know. It was a combination of passive. It was also a little bit of Matthews' defense. You have to give him credit. They did a really, really good job of being physical with Butler and not making bad foul calls. I think the kind of sense of familiarity that is bred by knowing each other for so as long as they did. They made that point during the TNT broadcast that, of course, Wes Matthews and Jimmy, having both gone to Marquette, knew each other. They played each other for a long time. So there's a sense of familiarity there, and that certainly showed. But Matthews seemed to know exactly what to do to hinder Butler, and he was just staying physical with him in a way that Butler, much to my surprise, couldn't find a way to match. He couldn't find a way to answer, or seemed like he was kind of willing to let Wes dictate how the whole thing took place. And it was a little strange to see Butler so passive, because, if again, in Game 1, he had been anything but that. And so you expect him to at least be able to draw calls, do something more to slow the pace down. That wasn't really evident. He had no jumper. He was unwilling to do so. And I'll talk a little bit more about what was wrong with the offense and with Jimmy in particular in the next segment. But it was a little strange to see Jimmy be such a non-factor. And still, Miami found a way to win. They keep getting contributions between the team's bench, between the scoring of Jay Crowder, who continues to be a phenomenal addition to this team, to getting a real boost from a 20-year-old rookie and a journeyman center. Well, maybe not journeyman in Kelly Olynyk, but certainly a guy who has never been a superstar. It's impressive to see Miami find a way to win. And this was against a very good team. You can say anything you want to about the Antetokounmpo factor, or that the Bucks played badly, or that they were basically a couple of foul calls away from a sweep in Game 4. But the reality is that this was a team that was very dominant during the regular season. As much as the credit has been given towards Miami, a lot of the blame has lied at the feet of Mike Budenholzer, the head coach for the Milwaukee Bucks. And though he struggled with some adjustments, I think a lot of that gets a little overblown. Because you can only play your top players so long without them finally breaking down or getting injuries or perhaps even worse. I mean, Antetokounmpo had sprained his ankle in Game 3. He re-injured it in Game 4. I don't know that it's fair to criticize Bud for his rotations and things of that sort, although I think many within Bucks media would scratch your heads a little bit about his lack of adjustments and things of that sort. There were questions as far as Budenholzer's coaching, but moreover, Miami did a really, really good job of adapting. They found a way to get contributions all over. I don't know that they necessarily made the kind of defensive adjustments in Game 5 that I would have liked to have seen. I would have wanted them to come out with a little bit more intensity and urgency, but again, considering Milwaukee's level of desperation, the fact that they were, well, just a few minutes from their season ending, they played the best game that I had seen from them in the Orlando bubble, and it was very consistent, and it still wasn't enough. Miami was able to do pretty much whatever they wanted to in the second half, even though it was a close game for some times there. Moreover, they were able to pull out find a way to win, and steal the victory. That's it. That's all you can hope for. Tyler Hero continues to be phenomenal. I think it's no secret that he's been a hell of a great player. He's confident beyond his years. I think the separation, the hiatus, if you will, really helped in many regards. Now, we've seen him struggle with some consistency issues. It's not like he's always going to have a phenomenal game, but he seemed to be energized in a way that Jimmy and Goran and other starters might not have been, and he was able to create his own shots so effectively. Behind his ability to just put the ball down, create off the dribble, make plays for others, he had a phenomenal no-look pass, I want to say, to Goran Dragic, that was just a hell of a play. There's just continued evolution from him, and of course, once he starts to get that long-range shot down, he's virtually unstoppable. So that's, you got to give him a lot of credit for being able to put in the work, and that's something that's been very consistently said about him all year long, is that he wants to continue to get better. He wants to be a great player. He's so young, and he was not fazed by the moment. He said, you know what, Game 5, let's seal this, let's move on, and he was doing everything possible, at least offensively, to make that a reality. On defense, look, there's still going to be holes in his game. Moreover, I think he just did a really, really great job of stepping up when, again, key veterans like Jimmy Butler and Goran Dragic were struggling to get their shots. Tyler met all comers. It didn't matter who was defending him, whether it was Matthews or Marvin Williams or Chris Middleton. He was able to get his shot pretty consistently. He had a good pace, a good rhythm going that a lot of players are not. And lastly, I want to say Eric Spoelstra had that coach's interview at the end of the first quarter. And he was so calm because, look, Miami, I think Heat Twitter was just falling apart at that point after the first quarter offensive explosion from the Bucks, where they looked like they were so energized and they were getting those key shots from DiVincenzo and Brook Lopez and others. It just felt like a much worse version of what we had seen in Game 4. There was no energy from Jimmy. He was turning the ball over all the time. It just seemed like he was out of it. And then Spoelstra comes out there and does that coach's interview. And she asked him questions. And man, Spo was so calm and even keeled. At a point when all of us watching, I think, were a little bit excited or pissed off or scared, Spo just answered those questions calmly, recognized that there was a long way to go, and sure enough, he was absolutely right. Miami found their rhythm, they got their contributions from guys that they did not expect off the bench, and of course, they were able to find a way to win and move on to the Eastern Conference Finals. That's the story of the game, nothing else to it. I'll get into some more takeaways and answer your questions about the game, so stay listening to Locked On Heat. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about DoorDash. Continue safely supporting the restaurants in your community. There are thousands of restaurants that are open for delivery and on DoorDash, and they need your patronage now more than ever. Support your local favorite restaurants by using DoorDash. Ordering is easy. Many of your favorite restaurants let you open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food will be left safely outside your door with a new contactless delivery drop-off setting. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off and zero delivery fees on their first order of $15 or more when they download the DoorDash app and enter the code LOCKEDONNBA. That's $5 off and zero delivery fees on your first order when you download the DoorDash app in the App Store and enter code LOCKEDONNBA. It's the app that brings you the food you're craving right now, right to your door. Don't forget, that's code LOCKEDONNBA for $5 off your first order with DoorDash. Subscribe to the show on your favorite app to listen to podcasts and always get the latest episodes by asking your smart device to play Locked On Heat when you get in your car to get your team every day. The good, the bad, the ugly is next. The good, Miami's bench. After struggling in Game 4 for the first time, I think in the Orlando bubble, the bench has long been a strength of Miami's, but certainly in Orlando, you really saw that kind of impact in the playoffs. When other teams are tightening their rotations, Miami has done so as well, but they're still able to pare it down to where it's the most efficient, and you get contributions from so many key players, and that was the case in Game 5. In Game 4, they had struggled. Milwaukee's bench actually wound up outscoring Miami's for the first time all series. I think the first time in the playoffs. I can't recall a time when the Pacers' bench, as bad as they were able to outscore Miami's bench. But in Game 5, they responded back. When the starters looked so sluggish, so out of sorts, Miami's bench, led by Kelly Olynyk, with 17 minutes, 12 points, 6 rebounds, an assist, 1 steal, 2 blocks, and a plus-minus 22, the second best on the team. That was such a factor. Kelly looked so impressive. Like, there's no other way around it. Either he was being defended by smaller wings or even a stretch four like Marvin Williams, or if Lopez was in the game, he was able to get around him, defend him well, just match up as well as possible. He's a 7-footer, maybe 6'11 at best, but he's a legit tall player that can do so much between his ball handling, his floor spacing, his passing ability. It's such a complete and total package when Kelly looks this engaged. Now look, Olynyk has struggled with consistency. Bubble Kelly looked phenomenal early on during the seeding games, and he kind of struggled against the Pacers at times, and you weren't quite sure what you were to get from him out of the Bucks. But in Game 5, he was as good as advertised, and he was the very best version of him, and hopefully this is the kind of version we'll get when the Heat wind up facing the Boston Celtics in the next round. I'm calling it from here. I don't think the Raptors have a chance of tightening up that series. I think it's going to be Boston all the way in Game 6 of that series, but that's a whole other issue for another day. As far as Miami's bench is concerned, they also got really good production from Kendrick Nunn. 22 minutes, 6 points. Not a phenomenally gaudy production line from him, but as he continues to work his way back, and again, I've already said, I don't think the COVID diagnosis is what really is wrong with Kendrick. I think he's just been out of sorts, well, ever since the season ended. I don't think it has anything to do with COVID whatsoever. I think even before that, he had games and long stretches where he could be very ineffective on offense, and there wasn't much else as far as his defense or passing is concerned that warranted any kind of extended playing time. Against the Bucks in Game 5, we started to see little stretches of that defense where he just looked engaged. He looked energetic. He was a boost of energy. Whether he was producing or not, he was making an impact. And he got the minutes over Derrick Jones Jr., who had a nice Game 4 and unfortunately didn't get a chance to play very much. He didn't play at all in Game 5, surprisingly. I hope that doesn't create any friction there, because this has been such a great team with such great chemistry all season long. And it's a little surprising to see Nunn get those minutes over Derrick Jones Jr., who I think could have provided a little bit more defense on some stretches. But Kendrick, to his credit, played really good defense. He made plays. He was looking sharp out there. This was the best version of him that I've seen in Orlando. So I have to say, if he's going to get playing time moving forward, hopefully he's continuing to build off of this showing, because it was a pretty great impact that I think he had, again, in 22 minutes of play. Andre Iguodala, while he only had 6 points, again, continues to make all the right decisions. He's a guy that just doesn't seem to ever really lose focus. He knocks down a shot here and there. He gets the right play done. He has really sharp instincts on defense. I think there was, I can't recall now, I want to say Chris Middleton. It looked like Middleton was going to get it going in the fourth, or it was knocking down a couple shots. I believe it was Middleton, and I apologize for not having the exact series of events directly at my disposal here. But there was a player from the Milwaukee who looked like it was going to get going, drove the lane, spun, looked like he was going to get a clear shot there. And as he was pulling that spin move, Andre brought his hand down at the perfect time, swatted the ball out, and initiated a fast break that led to a bucket and a foul. I think it was a hero bucket and a foul. Just a kind of right momentum play. And that's what it is. It's not just making a smart play on defense or making a big shot on offense. It's plays that have serious impact by virtue of swinging momentum in Miami's favor. And that's all you can pretty much hope for. Now, again, of course, Tyler Hero, another big part of that bench, but those four players comprised all of Miami's production off the bench, and they were phenomenal. Just a great showing for them. You know, again, Solomon Hill hasn't played in the series. Myers Leonard did not play in the series. Derek Jones Jr. did not play. And, of course, Udonis Haslem continues to not play. So, along with KZ Okpala, Gabe Vincent, and their young players, they're not going to get any playing time against the Boston Celtics. So I think this is the core of Miami's rotation moving forward. It's nine men deep, and it's a pretty good, solid group. I think you're going to see Derek continue to get spot minutes here and there in the next series. But either way, a strength of Miami's, and it certainly showed in Game 5. That was the factor. The bad, Miami's offense looked really sluggish for a big stretch there. I made a point during the game on Twitter, and I think it was, looking back now, felt much worse in the moment, because there were stretches there where everything looked so bad for Miami offensively, particularly from that starting group. And a lot of that had to do with Goran and Jimmy Butler. When Goran is not stretching the floor because his shot's not falling as it was tonight, he finished 7 of 15 from the floor. Not a great shooting night. Just 2 of 5 from three-point range. Not terrible. Not horrible. Just not great. We've seen so much better from him during the Orlando bubble, even earlier in the series, and he did not seem like he was particularly locked in for Game 5. But when his shot's not falling the way it was, and the defenses aren't respecting him to the same level that they have on other occasions, Miami's offense can get bogged down pretty quickly. And a lot of that had to do with both Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo holding the ball, not willing to take jumpers. And there was one play in particular that, even after I had tweeted this out, I saw Jimmy get the ball on the elbow. Wes Matthews was coming off of a screen, went under the screen, and Jimmy had time. He could have just rose up, shot the jumper, seen what would have happened, but his unwillingness to do so, because that long-range shot has not been there so consistently for him, that Miami then winds up letting Milwaukee's defense, or an opponent's defense, get back into their half-court defense where they can slow things down, and then you have Bam unwilling to shoot the jumper, although whenever he does have a lot of room, he's been knocking that down with some familiarity, but most often than not, he's not going to be comfortable taking the 15 to 18 foot jumper. If he catches it on the elbow from 18 to 20 feet out, he's not going to do anything from that range. And so you've got two non-shooters there, and then you've got another factor in Goran Dragic, who's not really spacing the floor. And then you've got Duncan Robinson, who is not able to create off the dribble. He's not creating his own shot. He's constantly coming off of screens, multiple screens, re-screens, waiting for that dribble handoff from either Jimmy or Bam in particular. And then as a result, he's constantly moving out without the ball, but he's not doing anything. And so you have these long possessions where the shot clock winds up winding down, and then you don't have anybody to either get to the rim efficiently, especially with Brook Lopez in there clogging the paint as much as he does. A lot of that, and there was, again, a great piece from The Athletic that I had talked about before the series even started that highlighted how good Lopez is, where he's very, very good at walking the line between the three-second violation and how much time he spends in the painted area. Very, very good. He got the All-NBA second-team defensive nod there, along with Bam Adebayo, I should mention, who was also a all-second NBA defensive team selection. So kudos to Bam on a phenomenal season. But with Lopez there, it's just so much harder to get to the shots at the rim that you might want. And then you have to kind of kick it out to the perimeter. And without Duncan knocking down that shot, with Milwaukee's defense playing as well as it possibly has, I think it was just a really ugly offensive outlook from Miami. And then Jay Crowder was effectively your only legitimate catch-and-shoot player to stretch the floor. It was very weird to see this kind of Miami offense where you only have Jay out there as your legitimate long-range threat because Duncan was being guarded so heavily, and then Jimmy and Bam don't knock down those shots. You got Goran not knocking down the shot. It just looked very ugly. And speaking of ugly, that's my last takeaway from this, is that the Bucks were a much easier challenge than Miami could have hoped. They were the perfect opponent for Miami. And Miami also has yet to play as well as they possibly can. But unfortunately, I don't think they've ever really been truly challenged either. And that's a concern because, look, the Indiana Pacers were undermanned. You kept hearing about T.J. Warren and his phenomenal level of play. And we never really saw that kind of impact that we were expecting from the Bucks. They never got Domas Sabonis. They were missing their key bench player in Jeremy Lamb. This was a bad version of that team. And Victor Oladipo, not yet at 100%. That seems like an eternity ago now, thinking about it. But then against the Bucks, again, you had that perfect game plan of limiting Giannis Antetokounmpo, and then you don't see anybody else in that rotation, whether Middleton or Bledsoe or Lopez, have the kind of impact that they're capable of. Miami never really got challenged until Game 4, and even in Game 5 when they were challenged to some degree, they just kind of coasted through a lot of the game, got the contributions they needed from Hero and Olynyk and others, and found a way to win. While that's a positive, it's also kind of a potential concern, especially against a team like the Boston Celtics, who I think will be the next round opponent in the Eastern Conference Finals. They're deep, they play hard, they have some incredible defensive players in Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and of course Marcus Smart, who was a first-teamer on the All-NBA defense selection. So I think Daniel Tice as a starter there is a very underrated player who I think needs to get a little bit more attention from the Miami Heat faithful moving forward because he is an impact player as well. And I have concerns about Jimmy Butler. He was looking tired after the game, and I think a lot of that had to do with the supreme effort of trying to get open and the defense the defensive intensity that Wes Matthews guarded him with. But he also looked tired during the game, and I made this point. I can't recall exactly now who it was who disagreed with me, but I'm wondering if Butler's having a hard time finding motivation after so long in the bubble. And I think that's another big part of it, is that the bubble is starting to become a problem. This is a difficult way of living day in and day out. You lose touch with the reality. You've been there for almost 3 months now. It's got to be an impossible feeling of just being in. Look, it's a hotel. It's a resort. But you're also there. And they're not inviting players. These players in particular, Goran and Jimmy, aren't inviting family members. So it's not like they're getting any kind of real established connection to the outside world other than FaceTime or the occasional phone call and things of that sort. I know it's a business trip for them, but I wonder, both Jimmy and Goran have started to look tired in games 4 and 5, and I wonder if it's that lack of family connection. I really do. I don't know if there's anything else to it. It's just weird how they've developed this kind of connection to the point where both of them are struggling at the same time, whereas both of them were thriving at the same time before. So hopefully they'll be able to turn it on for the next series, because it's going to be a tough challenge either way. But I just wanted to point that out there. And I'll talk about who the better matchup in the Eastern Conference Finals are, and I'll answer that and more in the next segment. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Now, I've talked about it before, but Built Bar is absolutely the best tasting protein bar I've ever had. I've enjoyed being able to get a Built Bar on the go when I'm trying to cram so much into my day, whether it's covering the games or driving around or taking care of my son. Look, he's 20 months going on a handful, and it's so hard to keep up with him sometimes. But if I need a snack and I don't have time to get a meal in or prepare anything or have anything, you know, leftovers from the night before, no problem. You just grab a Built Bar, and that keeps you going. It's got all the nutrients that I need in order to fill me with the energy I need in order to keep up with my son. And look, it's great. They've got so many great flavors. 18 amazing flavors, including 6 new ones: caramel brownie, cookies and cream, cherry barcia, and my favorite, apple almond crisp. So tasty. All of them have been so great. They're 100% covered in chocolate, each and every flavor. It's so good. They're easy to chew. This isn't like eating your typical protein bar. Some of those can get really chalky. They don't taste particularly good. The ones that taste good are okay, and they're still really bad for you because they're kind of high in fat or kind of high in sugars. Built bars aren't like that. They're healthy. They're great for the health-conscious person. If you want to lose or maintain weight while indulging in a delicious treat, the bars are low-calorie, low-sugar, high-protein, and high-fiber. Everything that you're looking for in a protein bar. And right now, if you go to builtbar.com and use the promo code LOCKEDON, you'll get $10 off your next order. That's a great deal. You can mix and match. Build a box with whatever bars and flavors that you want. So go to builtbar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON, and get $10 off your next order at builtbar.com. Just a reminder, you can always reach me via email at lockedonheat@gmail.com or via Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat. As we move on in the finals, Eastern Conference Finals that is, I'll be talking to representatives from either the Boston Celtics or Toronto Raptors to get their takes on a potential matchup. I'll also be talking to some folks on the Milwaukee side of things to help put a bow on that series. It should be fun and keep you kind of interested in what's happening next. So make sure you stay tuned to my next episodes. Now, back to your listener questions. This one comes from both Jay Jacobson and Stephen Wang, who are absolutely different people. They asked the same two questions via Twitter. Very interesting. The first question was, who is the better matchup in the Eastern Conference Finals? Stephen asked, who would match up better with the Heat, Boston, or Toronto? My feeling is that the better matchup for Miami would be Toronto. They looked shaky. I pointed this out on the Locked On NBA National show on Tuesday morning, but my feeling is that they're one OG Anunoby miracle away from having been eliminated. They're down 3-2 as I'm recording this, and they don't seem to have an answer for Boston's depth. They've had some injury issues. OG Anunoby has been a very solid defender all season long, and he's a growing factor in offense, but he can't be relied on for his offense. So basically, he's out there as a defensive stopper more than anything else. You're going to have some, you know, undersized guards in Van Vliet and Lowry who both get to the line and can stretch the floor, etc. But even they've been limited somewhat by guys like Marcus Smart and Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown also. So Serge Ibaka has been hurt. Marc Gasol doesn't look like he's at 100% or anywhere close to it. So Toronto, I think, has used up all their magic to get to this point. They've exceeded expectations all season long, at least from my perspective, and I never really thought that they would go this deep in the playoffs. So they've been, I think, very, very good for much of the Orlando bubble, but now they've kind of been exposed, and maybe it's just kind of catching up to them. I'm not sure what's going on, but they're likely to get eliminated. Even as I'm recording this, my feeling is that Boston is going to be able to move on, and they're dangerous. They've been playing without Gordon Hayward, who's welcome to come back. I think he's quarantined now, and he's going to be rejoining the team soon. He's just another body that adds depth. He can stretch the floor. He can get to the line. He can do all the things that they're counting on him to do, but they're very good defensively. Look, Tatum has struggled from the field. He's not shooting as well as he did. Jaylen Brown has been phenomenal. Marcus Smart continues to do a lot. Tice has been really, really good. They're getting key contributions from guys off the bench, too. This is a very, very solid team, and they match up worse for Miami than the Raptors do because of that length, because they have a lot of wing players and great defense, and they can swing the ball around. They move it. Tice stretches the floor. He's also active around the boards, and that kills Miami. And then you've got a guy like Enes Kanter who can come off the bench and pull down a couple of rebounds, and he's basically going to be instant offense for the Boston Celtics. And so that's dangerous. That's not a great matchup for Kelly Olynyk to guard as far as the rotation players are concerned. So I don't like Boston as far as the next matchup is concerned. They're dangerous, and I don't like Miami's chances against them, to be 100% honest with you. I don't want to be a cold towel, on a really great day, because Miami has advanced and they have looked sharp against Milwaukee. But it's all about matchups. You see that throughout the playoffs where a team all of a sudden starts moving forward, especially when things are on such an even keel as they are in the Orlando bubble, where nobody has a clear advantage, nobody has home court advantage. You've got to be able to have it's about team depth. It's about those individual matchups on a player-to-player level. And Boston's really good. And you've got a guy like Smart who you can just kind of throw out there. He's been shooting so damn well. And so he's become a huge factor for Boston. And he's been inserted into that starting lineup without Hayward there. And I'd keep him in there because he's been so dangerous. He can defend so many players. Look, if you think If you think Eric Bledsoe has created a problem for Goran Dragic, wait till he tries to go up against, you know, Marcus Smart. That's going to be much more of a challenge for him. And then Smart's a guy who can body up Jimmy. He can body up Jay Crowder. He can do everything. He's going to be flying around there. And he flops a whole hell of a lot. So he's going to get a shit ton of calls in his favor. That's always the worst. It's like going up against a much younger, athletic version of Kyle Lowry, you know? That's always been a concern for Heat fans, so I would not like to see that at all. The second question that both Jade and Steven ask is Duncan Robinson broken, and how much leeway can the Heat afford if he's not hitting his threes? Will Duncan be more of a factor, is what Jade asks. Okay, Duncan is not broken. He is going to be able to get back on track. We saw that in Game 4, so I don't think that's the problem. My concern is that he is not being as effective as he once was, as consistently as he was. He looked so good against the Indiana Pacers, and then all of a sudden he wasn't against Milwaukee. Either way, he's still a factor. He is an effective decoy. You see this repeatedly where he's still continuing to draw attention. Look, nobody on the Boston side, just like nobody on the Milwaukee side, are going to stay away from Duncan because he's so dangerous, because the three-point shot is such a dangerous weapon and it can change the course of a game so completely. They're going to defend the hell out of him. Even if it's just somebody like in the games 1 and 2 of the Milwaukee series, you saw Chris Middleton guarding Duncan, coming off those screens repeatedly. That tired him out, and that's why Middleton was so ineffective in the second half. Against the Celtics, if he's going to be a factor at all, I don't see it, to be honest with you. I think we're going to see much more pressure on Duncan Robinson, especially from the Celtics, because they have those wing players that are young, quick, like Brown and Tatum. But that's a factor in its own way. Because they're going to be defending him, because they're going to be concentrating so much, that takes away a lot of their energy. A guy like Brown, Boston needs him to be a scorer on occasion. And if he's defending Duncan Robinson, and if he's trying to body him up, and he's trying to stay with him so much over the course of the game, even if it's just a decoy, maybe even if he's not getting those shots or those looks, either way, that tires out a guy like Brown. And so I think he's still going to be a factor. He still is a factor, even if he's not knocking down that shot, just because he's a long-range threat, he's a consistent threat, even if he's not making that shot. So to me, I've got no concern with it. I'd like to see him be able to knock down those open looks. I think he is a little rattled. I think the time off will try to do him a little better. You know, there's also the factor that he is from the New England area, and he did grow up a Celtics fan. So I wonder if we're going to see a version of him the way that we have Tyler Herro, who grew up in Wisconsin and probably rooted for the Bucks as a kid. I wonder whether or not we're going to see that from Duncan. That would be an interesting turn of events, so something to consider. David, great name by the way, states confidently via Twitter, Herro needs to start at point guard next series. I don't think so. It's a tough one. Look, I already pointed out that Marcus Smart's going to be a tough defensive matchup, and he's going to harass the hell out of Goran Dragic. I don't want that to happen to the kid. I don't want Herro to go in there and get harassed by Marcus Smart and be put, you know, basically on lockdown. Brad Wanamaker comes off the bench for Boston, and he's a solid backup, but I think Herro can get his points off of him, and I still think that Herro can thrive against, you know, backups. And so I think that's where he's most effective to this point. I thought earlier on that we might see more of the Herro starting option. Right now, I think Eric Spoelstra feels comfortable going with Goran as a starter. I don't think he's going to change that. I don't think he's going to see anything in the film that would indicate that Tyler needs to start. I think Goran's just more comfortable. And although he struggled in a couple of games against the Bucks, I think he'll be able to find his rhythm against Boston to some degree. We'll see how it goes. I think I prefer his veteran savvy out there, and I know I kind of made fun of that during the game because I think it's a phrase that's overused a lot for when it comes to a player like Goran Dragic. I still think that he's going to be the starter moving forward, and I think he can be an impactful player as a starter. I like Herro torching backups and playing when the game is on the line. We've seen that number of times. He's in that closing lineup for a reason. He's earned that spot. So I don't think it matters whether he starts or not. He's going to be an impact player. He's going to have an effect, especially if these are close games moving forward. Josh Van Meter asks, obviously Milwaukee would do whatever they can to retain Giannis, But given how well they played without him, do you think this series makes the Bucks more willing to part ways in the offseason? No, I don't. I think there's a lot of buzz about it. There's going to be some more continued buzz. We're going to see that. There was even a piece for The Ringer from Jonathan Yarks who wrote that it looks like I think the headline read, if Giannis is going to continue losing, then he needs to demand more or demand out. So that's kind of inflammatory because that's what a lot of journalism is nowadays. I also don't think he's going to ask for a trade. I think we've seen a couple of things. It seems like more and more buzz around league circles is that Giannis wants to stay there. And maybe it's the fact that he's a European-born player who's less willing to seek out trades and things of that sort if everything's going well. I think he wants to build something there. He's talked about the future and building a culture. Even today, he talked about building something, a long-term contender in the Milwaukee area. I think that there's going to be changes, but I don't think trading Giannis is one of them. And so one of the things that we're starting to see also outside of Milwaukee is that Billy Donovan has not been retained as the head coach of the Oklahoma City Thunder despite a very strong season, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they are rebuilding. So they're going to be making some changes. And if Donovan's out, then you know that they're going to be trading Chris Paul. They might be looking to move Steven Adams as well, but for now, they're definitely going to be trading Chris Paul. I don't know if there's going to be a strong taker there, but I could tell you that he would fit pretty well against Milwaukee. In Milwaukee, I think he's a guy who can get you those points down late. He's a guy who's been there. He's going to demand a lot from those players. You have him as your third star alongside Middleton and Adetokounmpo, and I think you become a stronger contender there than you did before. And again, I think that it's not going to take much to pry him out of there because he's basically an expiring contract that's getting paid a whole heck of a lot of money. And so you're basically doing the Oklahoma City Thunder a favor by taking him off your roster. So I wonder what kind of deal would be in effect. I guess it would be Eric Bledsoe and maybe a late first-round pick that's not going to convey anytime soon. Who knows? Either way, I think Paul to Milwaukee looks like a pretty good deal. I know somebody asked me about that via Twitter, and I didn't get to that question because it doesn't really fit into now. But I think Paul going to Milwaukee makes them a contender. I think who knows what's going to happen next season between Miami, between Brooklyn getting better, between Indiana getting their players back to full strength. There's going to be a lot of turnover. Even Washington, a team that a lot of people tend to disregard, they're getting John Wall back, who's a superstar. I mean, they're getting Bradley Beal back and healthy. He's going to be a hell of a player. Maybe they re-sign Davis Bertans. Who knows? It's going to be a great Eastern Conference, which is why you never throw games, where you always try to go as deep as you possibly can. You go into win-now mode. It's paying off for Miami. They made the acquisition of Andre Iguodala and Jay Crowder. Both of them have stepped up in key moments. Crowder has been phenomenal. I hope they re-sign him. I hope they pay him a ton of money this year to keep him here because he has been so damn good. He seems like, and Eric Spoelstra mentioned this, and I think we've all talked about this at some point or another, Crowder just fits in Miami so well. And Spoelstra said it after the game that when it comes to Crowder, it doesn't seem like he's been there for only months. It seems like they've been there for years. His leadership, his presence, his familiarity with the system, and of course the fact that he's able to stretch the floor and play defense the way he does, he's been great. So this is, you know, another example of a win-now situation where you weren't quite sure what this team was going to be and you didn't know what was going to happen with Justice Winslow and Dion and James. And then you make those trades and you say, well, Iguodala's an older player. Crowder's a guy who's a journeyman and not really effective. Hell, he's been as great as anybody on this roster. So you never really know. And it's paid off for Miami, who continues to put on a phenomenally fun and strong postseason run. And I'll be covering it as well as possible. So make sure you stay here to subscribe and follow this podcast, so you'll get the latest episodes of Locked on Heat as soon as it's out. I'm David Ramil, signing off and thanking you as always for your support.